So welcome, everyone, to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia, and also wherever you're Zooming from. Just those attendees that are coming into the building, the protocols are in effect. And also, please be aware of there are those that are sensitive to fragrances, so just keep that in mind. So during the pandemic, it has often been a comforting and joyful experience to Zoom to a meeting. It is important to recall the ULT Declaration. Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues or personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions that are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without distinctions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these declared traditions. And we have the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and it is: the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So we have our Sunday meetings at Theosophy Hall here at 1917 Walnut Street in Philadelphia. We open the doors on Sundays at 10:30, and the meeting begins promptly at 11 and ends promptly at 12. And of course, it's a hybrid meeting. So many are joining at home. And as this speaker here is at Theosophy Hall, and the next speaker will be at his residence. So that's the way we're working it for the foreseeable future. So today, well, we should say, okay, Sunday we have a series of lectures and talks, and this month the overall umbrella topic is the key of virtue. And last week, the topic was the keys of harmony and patience. This week, the keys of equal-mindedness and courage. And then next week, the keys of mental devotion and self-sacrifice. And of course, we have our ongoing ocean class, which begins at 7:30 to 8:45 on Wednesday evenings. And we have a roundtable discussion at 6:30 to 7:30 on Friday evenings. And we will be concluding the 64-page pamphlet, Echoes of the Orient, by William Q. Judge. We're doing the last three pages, which is section two of the 21st installment. And that's pages 62, 63, and 64. So, of course, all of our contributions are voluntary, of time, money, and service, and they are all most appreciated, although none are, nothing is imposed or implied. So let's get to the meeting now. We are here going to discuss in the first part the key of equal-mindedness. It's also known as viraga, which is the Sanskrit term, and our philosophy is peppered with many Sanskrit terms. So it's, we can look at it as even-mindedness, it's equanimity, it's we have to understand that man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, or a miniature of the universe, that all of the everything that's within man, all the minerals, substances, but also all the potencies which are unseen, are within the human frame, the temple of the Holy Spirit, as it's also known. So we are a replica of the entire universe. And control of self implies also control of nature. It is a courageous goal, and every possible effort does take courage. But that is our second talk, so we won't be talking about courage itself. Along the path of spiritual evolution, there are indeed many pitfalls and failures, but we need to keep up the effort undaunted. In the Gita, we are told that no one should remain equal-minded in happiness and sorrow. Excuse me, we're told that we should remain equal-minded in happiness and sorrow. We may not want to remain in sorrow. That would be, we don't think that that should be a goal, but it's a necessary, it's necessary, because we can't appreciate the sunshine without the cold winter blasts, certainly. So there are cycles in the philosophy. One of the second fundamental of the philosophy has to do with cycles. And but we need to be equal-minded in all these cycles. So you can only enjoy you can only really enjoy happiness when you've experienced sorrow as well, and we need to do with equanimity. If there's no sorrow, there's no appreciation of joy, and this may be a little hard to wrap your head around, but therefore we should welcome sorrow. For how else are we going to experience real happiness? So the philosophy is real happiness is that balance, that equipoise that one gets when we're not too high, we're not too low. And it's not the transitory happiness of the senses that we're all in this modern world with advertising. They, you know, we're expected to be happy all the time, but that's a transitory happiness. That's an ephemeral happiness. That's not true happiness and joy, which comes from within. It can't come from anywhere else. Otherwise, it's not really real. Here's a little poem. It says, it's pleasure and pain, good and bad coexist. None can separate them. You cannot find pleasure or pain, good or bad, to the exclusion of the other. Pleasure results when difficulties fructify. So it's the fruit of the difficulties is the knowledge and the joy and the lessons and the learning. In day-to-day life, we have no value for day if there is not night. We said that earlier. So when we experience hardships and trials, these are, you know, they are difficult. This is when we really have to, we can consult the Stoic philosophers because they're very good as well. You know, these theosophical teachings are, and they come from many sources and we can find them in many places. So you can never enjoy true peace and happiness, but unless you experience these trials. Pleasure is an interval between two pains, is another way to put it. One who understands this truth will neither be elated by happiness nor depressed by sorrow. Some, more than a few, have ruined their good name and reputation for the sake of trivial, mean, and momentary worldly pleasures and petty gains. Thereby, they subject themselves to disrepute. And we see this all the time, where people in position are tempted for quick monetary gains to act in an unethical way, hoping that they're not going to get caught. But there's a higher law than the laws of society, and that is karma. And even if we don't have to suffer in this lifetime for our actions, all our thoughts, words, and deeds, they will come home to roost in some time in the future. You know, we think about Arjuna in the first chapter, who he did not want to fight. He did not want to do his duty. But as a Kshatriya of the warrior caste, there is no greater duty than doing his obligation in a lawful war. So we need to try to raise ourselves above the pairs of opposites and to assume a mindset that is patience sweet that naught can ruffle. So concentration and meditation are essential keys to equanimity, as well as there is still another factor we have not yet mentioned, without which we are not building on a firm foundation. So our next speaker will explore the quality of courage and its place in the path we are treading.
Friends, before beginning a consideration of the key of courage, we thought it would be good for us to begin with some definitions. So courage is defined as firmness of mind and will in the face of danger or extreme difficulty. In other words, courage is a human attribute, a heart quality, yet gives one the ability to move forward towards their intended goal despite their fear and obstacles. And interestingly enough, the word courage is derived from the French word for heart, cœur. Now, in the voice of the silence, the fifth virtue is called in Sanskrit virya, and it is sometimes translated or understood to mean courage. And certainly it encompasses courage, but it is more. So in the voice of the silence, we read that virya is that dauntless energy that fights its way to the supernal truth out of the mire of lies terrestrial. Notice there that the word is used dauntless. And so we want to get a definition of or a meaning for that word dauntless. So this key of virya or virtue is not just courage. It is dauntless, meaning fearlessness and determined energy. So one can be courageous because they are aware of their fear, but they are able to put their fear aside in order to achieve the goal, the end in view. And courage is a remarkable quality. I mean, that's the stuff of our heroes. And when you talk to heroes, they'll very often say, well, I only did what any other human being would do. Well, of course, if any other human being could have put aside their fear of the moment and get done or do what they needed to get done, they would be considered heroic too. And our society admires and emulates and praises and builds statues and monuments to the heroes. But one who is dauntless is fearless, meaning they have no fear. They are not aware of fear, so there's no fear to put it aside. Rather, what they have is determination to overcome whatever obstacle may be in their way to achieve the goal in view. So there is a difference here between what we think of as virya or dauntless energy, and it's a wonderful thing, courage. So with virya, the goal is spiritual. Now courage, personal courage, mental, moral courage will take us to a certain level, and a pretty good level in our spiritual evolution. But to go beyond a certain point, courage has to be replaced by this dauntless energy in order to achieve the spiritual goal here, which is the acquirement of the highest enduring truth of spiritual wisdom and the desire to help others. Because compassion, the embodiment of that desire to help others, is based on awareness of the highest spiritual truths. So we see that virya is different in its nature, it's different in its goal, but it's also different in the power or energy that has to be evoked. And whereas desire to achieve a goal in spite of our fears is the motivating energy for courage, the motivating energy for virya, or that fearlessness in the achievement of our goals, is the will. Now, we obviously, there must be a relationship between this keys of virtue, whether we're considering courage or fearlessness, and the other keys of virtue that we've already discussed, charity, love, harmony, patience, and just this morning, equal-mindedness. It should become clear to us that if we are going to be courageous, it's going to help us if we are filled with charity, if we are patient, if we can put aside and be indifferent to the pleasures and pains of life, if we can learn to find harmony with others. All these things will help us put aside our fears and be courageous. But courage is also needed to practice charity, harmony, and patience and indifference, because in trying to develop these qualities, these virtues, we are still aware of some personal fears that need to be put aside so we can be courageous in developing them. And we thought it might be useful. We've spoken about the various keys we've previously talked about, but we thought it might be interesting to just take a little bit closer look at the fears all human beings have to put aside to some degree. It's not a comprehensive list, but it gives a pretty good menu of what we need to recognize as a fear and be willing to put aside because of the intensity of our desire to achieve the goal, whatever it is, for that human being. And so the first thing we have to realize is that the presence of fear in general is going to kill all our action and determination. What prevents people most from achieving their goals is fear. And the first thing we realize as we enter this path of spiritual development is it's going to depend on our self-induced and self-devised effort. In other words, we're going to have to learn to be self-reliant and have unshaking faith in our ability to accomplish this goal. So the first fear that arises is doubt in one's ability to achieve the goal, whether the goal is to bear love to all as if they were our brothers and sisters. This requires a lot of personal courage because we're surrounded by influences from science and religion and our society that tend to instill this doubt that we need to be dependent on others or at least things outside ourselves. So to have unshaking faith in one's ability to love unconditionally, or at least all equally, as much as we can, takes courage. What are some of the other fears that might get in the way of our ability to express our love? Well, there is certainly the fear of hurting the feelings and isolating those we love. We may love others and when we want to help them, but in telling them what they need to hear, they might be offended by it, or they might withdraw from us, and they might respond instead of with gratitude, with harsh criticism and condemnation. And that's particularly something we might fear from those we love, but even our society may be suspicious and critical and condescending towards that kind of love. We know we have rife in our society and around the world, a polarity. And those who try to be charitable to all concerned, some of them find themselves the enemies of both camps. So it takes courage. There's also the fear of going on alone if we have to, without having to rely on the approval, love, and praise of others. So often it's easiest for us to be harmonious and loving and caring. But if we tend by that to realize that we're going to have to do this on our own, even if we don't get the support of our family or friends, we have to be willing to do that and overcome that fear of that social isolation. There's also the fear of failure to achieve one's goals. And this is the kind of fear that comes from experience. Experience of the obstacles. We've taken it up courageously and we proceeded, but we see it's not as easy as we thought. There's going to be a lot of difficulties and we're going to stumble many times. And we begin to doubt that maybe we bit off more than we can chew. And so that fear to keep trying, to keep going in spite of the pitfalls and increasing difficulties has to be put aside if we're going to keep trying. And then there's the fear of leaving behind that which is familiar. We all fall into a certain rut of thought, of feeling, of behavior, of personal considerations, of bodily considerations that we're comfortable with. Everybody's comfortable with. It's natural, we're told. And yet, in order to proceed, we sometimes have to leap or take a leap from that which we're comfortable with to a new perspective that is unfamiliar. Even the idea of genuinely caring and having thought for the needs of others and not have to think about ourselves and what's going to happen to ourselves all the time generates a certain fear that has to be put aside. And then in trying to do that, we realize, oh, we're not as good as we thought. We may want to be loving, but we have lots of faults and we have lots of vulnerabilities and we have lots of weaknesses. And sometimes the greatest fear is the fear to face the truth of our own imperfect nature and acknowledge the responsibility that we have for that. We've caused that. We can't blame it on our families. We can't blame it on society. We have to face the fear, but also face the realization that only we caused it and only we can get rid of it. And that requires courage. We've talked about the fear of leaving behind certain things we may desire or certain concerns about the body and the personality and personal achievement. But we have to leave behind also familiar viewpoints, attitudes about life, about ourselves that we learned, and adopt a new, more universal perspective, universal ideas that will help give us more consideration and live in a spiritual way, occupied by universal thought. And we'll see that that's very difficult. We've developed a certain familiarity and we know how fearful people can be when they have to jump from what is familiar to that which is unfamiliar. People will put up with the most despairing, horrible, difficult conditions that they realize is no good for them because they're comfortable with it. And the idea they have to jump to something better, which is unknown to them, inspires fear. So all these fears and many others are present at the initial stages, and it can only be put aside by moral courage and mental courage fed by the desire or higher aspiration to achieve the end in view. And it is no small task. And if we achieve this or any one of them or any number of them, we have come very far in life. But then this virya quality comes in because we realize that if we really want to achieve spiritual knowledge, wisdom, compassion, if that's the goal we started out with, there are some obstacles that we have to overcome that don't inspire fear. They're just difficult. And no amount of desire that we have can help us overcome them. It's sort of Arjuna finds himself in this situation in the Bhagavad Gita when he complains to Krishna. He says, I find the mind difficult to control. It seems to be as restless as the wind. Or he says, I find the mind to be very restless. It seems to be as difficult to control as the wind. And what Krishna responds to him is, well, it can be controlled by practice and dispassion. And dispassion is sometimes interpreted as meaning the absence of desire. So obviously, from what Krishna is saying, we can achieve it through practice, but desire is not going to get us there. And in fact, the wrong kind of desire can be an obstacle. So what kind of obstacles we are referring to here? And we're talking about the wandering nature of the mind. Our mind always tends to return to personal concerns and the memory of personal and earthly thoughts and experiences and sensations. And we may choose a goal, but then our mind wanders off to other activities and we seem to lose focus. Our energy and our focus seems to be diffused over other areas. And the attention of the mind very often drifts to that which is changing and temporary by its nature rather than that which is of permanent, enduring value. So we find we want to achieve that which is spiritual, which is permanent, which is enduring, which is compassionate, which is truth, but our mind seems to not want to stay there. It seems very restless. And that's where this viraga comes in, that dauntless energy, that spiritual energy. And as we said, the power that needs to be directed or awakened, if we want to use that term, is that of the will or the spiritual energy of will. So will then is a colorless universal force. It is spirit in action. It is that spirit in action that drives the universe, we might say, in all its departments of nature. But in the human being, spiritual will is also illimitable and exhaustless. It's the power of the spirit within. We require that spirit within to accomplish whatever we need to do. But more specifically, that spiritual will is the will and guidance of the higher self, or that divine essence within us. And it is because we are godlike in essence that we have the will to achieve whatever we choose. Whatever we choose. Now, normally, in the human being, what we need to do is we need to consciously give an impulse and direction to that spiritual will. It's there, but we need to consciously give it an impulse and direction. And we do that by the desires we have. So there is the old expression, behind will stands desire. So it means once we have a desire, and very often it's a personal desire, we awaken the will to achieve it. And when people say, I don't have the will to do something, which they mean is, I don't have enough desire to do it. And so the problem is that our personal desires, because they're limited in idea, and they're limited in goal, and they're limited in intent, they also limit the exercise of that spiritual will. And they don't allow us to achieve those degrees of control and discipline that will lead to spiritual knowledge. So how do we develop this spiritual will if we can no longer use desire or personal desire? And in a way, we go to that Lord's Prayer because it's very interesting and esoteric. You know, we have that expression, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And what that refers to is the fact that our spiritual will comes into play when we stop asserting our personal will and our personal self and surrender or renounce their intentions to the will and guidance of the higher self, the higher will. So it requires some knowledge to understand what are the purposes, what are the laws, what is the meaning for existence, why are we here? And once we do that, we begin to practice devoting ourselves to that universal good rather than our personal interests. Now, we may have at the beginning very personal interests and regards, but we make them, as it says, bond maidens to devotion. We acquire whatever we can in a personal way and nurture whatever we can in a personal way in order to put it at the service of all, something higher than ourselves. And it's interesting, the word Islam itself means surrender, surrendering the personal to the will of the divine. And we find this, as mentioned, in all religions, in Judaism and Christianity and Islam, Eastern religions. It's a spiritual truth. So it takes practice, it takes wisdom, and in the result is dispassion. And what that means is we no longer feel personal will, personal desire per se, that motivates us. We have a will to do something, and that will energizes the desire. It's the complete reverse. Usually we need a strong desire, a personal desire to energize the will. But once we begin to subjugate that will to the higher and generate that spiritual will, that dauntless energy, it strengthens our desire to achieve the higher. And it strengthens our ability to control the mind. And the mind begins to be subdued. We find it easier to be able to place it where we want, whether it's in meditation or in the conduct of our lives and the relationship to others. That will, awakened by our sacrifice, our devotion to the higher, to the universal good, brings all our like tumbling blocks, like locks, like the tumblers in a lock, brings them all into harmony so that we can open up the doors to that practice of higher wisdom and virtue and compassion without any obstacles. The mind falls into place, the heart falls into place, the use of the body falls into place. Everything becomes an instrument of that will. So that is a big step, that's an advanced step. And it requires an adept to do that self-consciously with knowledge. And we might say the adept is measured to the degree that awakened spiritual will controls the principles of the adept's nature. But we can at least begin where we are in asking ourselves, every day, to what extent are we sacrificing the dearer, the personal, for what is better? What is better for our family? What is better for our friends? What is better for our community, our nation? And bit by bit, develop that strength, that virya quality, bit by bit, bringing out the will. And as Krishna says, it takes practice. It's not going to come easy. But in the meantime, we will develop the courage to overcome many of the fears that people are usually inhibited by. And that in itself is a great achievement in any one life. So we'll stop here and invite you to ask any questions or present any comments you might have on this study. Oh, okay. MDW.
This sounds very much like reading the Bhagavad Gita. That, you know, there's a conduct of life in which we need to follow, not to create, you know, adverse circumstances in the future. So, you know, the Gita talks about not looking for the results of one's actions, you know, being equal-minded, you know, and not living for the personal, but living for the universal. So this is what came to mind listening to the presentations this morning. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so as we said, it's present in various religions. We talked about the Lord's Prayer. We see it in Judaism, in the performance of the many, what they call mitzvahs or deeds or obligations to the divine, which bit by bit subjugate the personal to the higher. We find it in Islam. So we see there the practice of surrender to something that's higher than oneself. Of course, there's obviously differences of understanding of what that higher is, but we see the same aspiration presented.
We have a contribution or question in the audience here. Go ahead.
It's interesting with these two virtues because it seems that in order to develop courage, one has to be equal-minded. Can't be too afraid. You can't, and then again, you can't really be too, almost like too cocky with what you want to do because you have to remain centered in order to become courageous. You can't be too full and of yourself, so to speak.
Did everyone hear that? Because we should summarize. So in order to develop courage, one needs to be equal-minded. Can't be too cocky. Anything else?
You can't be too afraid.
Can't be too afraid.
So just stay in the center.
So we need to be centered. Well, yeah, that's the idea. Finding that center, well, isn't that our quest? Isn't that everyone's quest? Because when we're constantly flying off the handle, as it were, or freaking out, or every little thing sets us off, then we're not in a good place. And it's very uncomfortable for ourselves and everyone else around us. No one really enjoys the company of somebody who is just has a hair trigger temper. So that's the goal, to find that center and also to help others along the path to the extent that we're able to help them.
it's interesting that we spoke of the root of the word courage being in that French word cœur, but another word, bravery, which is sometimes confused with courage, comes from a word that means boldness. And so we know that we can see many people who are brave and bold, but they're also foolhardy. So we have that expression, angels fear to tread where
fools go, where angels
fear to tread. Where angels fear to tread. Yes, thank you. The idea that what creates that foolishness that allows us, we can be brave, we boldly assert, but at the same time we're foolish, and what is it seems as though our reason has become slave to our passions. We're not equal-minded. Our reason becomes slave to our ambition, to our desire for praise, to our determination display ourselves in a certain way, to not all sorts of things where we might be a little more discreet and wise. We foolhardily go ahead. So yes, as was said, courage requires patience and charity, just as the practice of patience and charity requires courage. They're interdependent there. They're all expressions of one virtue.
Anyone else? It's something also that we have to think about is that dispassion, that higher indifference, which was going into, but it's something that it really, really takes a lot of practice to be dispassionate and to meet all things in a state of repose, finding that center. So putting away all passion, we don't need to attack or defend, as it were, but we need to be present for others rather than being too quick to counter what someone has said. It doesn't matter if it's erroneous. For them in that moment, that's their truth, as it were. And so that's what the philosophy is all about, is finding that center, finding truth, which are eternal verities, and not relative truth, but absolute truth. But of course, we live in a world of relative truths and of phantasmagoria, really. But these illusions are here for us to see beyond, to learn from.
So dispassion there does not mean we don't care.
Right.
We do care, but we will to care because we understand ourselves and why we are here, and we're not going to let our personal desires to be appreciated and praised or our fear of being condemned or used get in the way or prevent us or making us too fearful or upset to care for those, even those that don't treat us well. We think that's part of the message of Christianity, or at least as we have it from the teachings, where he says, oh, it's very easy to love your friends, but love your enemies. And of course, Judge in the letters speaks of him trying to realize that extend his understanding of himself to include not just his friends, but his enemies as well, or those that would oppose him. They are also an aspect of himself, and to care for them as much as he would care in an equal-minded way, in a courageous way, with those careful friends and enemies alike, the same way. MDW, you had your hand up.
Well, we think that, doesn't it simply come down to our higher nature and our lower nature, and that gaining some kind of control over our lower nature takes willpower, and that those lower desires, by us controlling them, doesn't that transmute them into this dauntless energy that we now, that you know, that our, you know, that we are conquering our lower desires, and it's really, they're being automatically transmuted into our higher, because we are, our motive for change is to benefit others.
So if you could express that, then, oh, sorry, were you finished?
Oh, yeah. No, just selfless service is being the ideal.
So that's that last sentence is the key there, that we don't kill the desires, we transmute them by placing our desires at the service of something higher. Not so desire things for our personal self-interest and advancement and pleasure and development and how in our standing, but rather to develop through individual, and we might say personal effort, those qualities that will be helpful and useful to more than ourselves. And bit by bit, we become more concerned for the interests of others than ourselves. And we learn by this law of cause and effect that as we help others, we at the same time help ourselves. So it's not that we develop the spiritual will. It's always there. We just get out of its way by bringing our personal lives more in harmony with the life of spirit, the life of our higher nature.
So viraga is indifference to pleasure and to pain. It's illusion conquered and truth alone perceived. So it's that higher indifference is illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. That's the goal. So the perceiver has to be freed from the thraldom of the senses. Virga is the attunement of the senses, emotions, and mind to the individuality, that eternal pilgrim, that Atma, Buddhi, and Manas, the three higher, that part of us, the higher trinity, which is the eternal pilgrim, that immortal part of ourselves. And that Lord's Prayer is a will prayer. It's a prayer to our higher self. We're asking for strength, that part of us that is not fully manifest yet, because really only in an adept or a master is it fully manifest. And we are on that path toward that ship.
It's interesting that we, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's mention of those three qualities of sattva or truth, rajas or passion or desire, and tamas or indifference. And they are different, and they do bind the soul because we still have that separative idea and identify with them, and they have control over us. But we're told that for each one, there's a higher aspect. And when we look at the higher aspect of those qualities, they're all referring to the same thing. The higher aspect of truth is that which is universal and not separative from anything. The highest aspiration is, the highest aspect of rajas or desire is will, which is one with spirit, one with that universal essence. And the highest aspect of indifference is the quietness and peace and bliss of the mind that has identified with that which is universal. So they all lead back to the same root when we're practicing. What gets in the way, of course, is our personal attachments. And so the practices we put out of indifference to the personal, indifference to pleasure and pain, is what is going to allow us to advance further, or at least create less problems for ourselves in our present life.
We have a Theosophy Hall here. Go ahead.
We periodically hear on the news about people who have performed incredible feats.
We hear about incredible feats on the news. Go ahead.
And
Okay, we'll come back to you. Well, we do hear about incredible feats. And that, is that the will? Is that in action where it just knows how to act? And go ahead.
We think here you're speaking of incredible feats of physical strength. And what's happening here is the person in the moment. I mean, we know we can desire all we want. I mean, if we want, we could all desire all we want to lift a 500-pound bar, but it's not going to happen. And yet, these individuals in this condition can lift 2 and 3 times that weight, because in the moment, their personal will has, and their personal selves and consideration has been completely annihilated, and all they're focusing on is something higher in themselves and the other, and to accomplish that. And that, as was said, brings out the spiritual will. That spiritual will acts on the tool that is needed for its manifestation. In this case, it's the physical body. And the physical body assumes a strength that it doesn't happen for. Now, the adept can do that at will, can magnify the strength of the body at will, rather than having to wait for something unforeseen or, quote, accidental to arouse that.
We have a follow-up. Go ahead.
So when these feats of courage, usually it's when the adrenaline kicks in. So would that be considered courage, or is that bravery?
Well, that's interesting. Adrenaline, the effect of adrenaline physiologically is said to stimulate that fight or flight. So what do we do in the face of that fight or flight response, which we experience as fear? Well, the rise of adrenaline, the sensation of fear, we either run away from it or we determine to stand our ground and endure it. So in either case, it's something noxious or threatening or potentially painful that we fear that comes up, and then we choose how to respond by our previous actions, by our character, by our ideas, whether we're going to run away from it in some way, or hide from it, or put it under the carpet, or ignore it, or repress it, or whether we're going to deal with it firmly, because that's what we need to do, that's what we want to do to get past that difficulty.
So we have still have a couple minutes here. Anyone else want to make a contribution? So, well, fear, yeah, it's there's fight or flight, but some people freeze. They just freeze in place. And but if we do have courage and indifference, then we should be able to act appropriately under all circumstances. So that is a goal, to get to get unstuck, as it were. Yeah, freezing is, it is a response, and one never knows when that could happen.
Well, we wanted to just come to the conclusion on that, that yes, freezing is an inaction, a fear, and it's a kind of withdrawal and running away. And as we said, we want to get over that. So we do want to remind you that this coming Wednesday, we will be taking up karma, the universal law, in our Wednesday night study class. And coming up on Friday, as was mentioned, this coming Friday, next Friday, we'll be finishing up the sections in the Echoes from the Orient. So thank you, and have a courageous weekend.
Okay, very good. Bye-bye.